Welcome to the podcast where heavy industrial industries meet the venture capital ecosystem, interviewing both thought-leading investors and pioneering founders to better understand the opportunities and challenges that lie ahead for digital industrial innovation. Your host is Ty Finley, and this is the Heavy Hitters Podcast.
Sarah Liu joins us today from Austin, Texas. Sarah is a partner at Fifth Wall, where she focuses on early stage built world investments and leads their fintech and construction tech pods, while also driving efforts around AI's implications for the built world. Prior to Fifth Wall, she spent time in private equity real estate at Divco West and then strategic consulting and transformations at McKinsey. Some of her investments in this ecosystem include Assigner and Document Crunch, amongst many others. Sarah, it's great to have you on to chat all things built world, certainly an ecosystem where things are changing fast. I think just today we saw Trimble make an acquisition that they are now in turn going to make their own version of Trimble Pay product. So lots going on, but thanks for joining and welcome to the Heavy Hitters.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to be here, Ty. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, we always start same place. I give a little snippet of the introduction, but walk us through, you know, your journey and what led you to venture and now leading the built world investments at Fifth Wall.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, I spent a little bit of time in private equity real estate, but I realized pretty quickly, to be honest, that the traditional asset management side of things, you know, there was not that much technology there. And I wanted to be somewhere with a little bit more of an innovation focus. During my time at McKinsey, I was out of the San Francisco office. I did a lot of work around kind of digital transformation, some work around innovation and TMT specifically while I was there. So got some exposure across different industries. But ultimately, you know, my path to venture, I'll fully admit, was, you know, a lot of luck and serendipity. One of the guys I worked with at McKinsey actually was roommates with one of our co-founders here, Brad Groey. When they were at Harvard, they played football together. And when Brad mentioned he was starting this fund, it was him, Casey, who actually brought me over because he saw that the fund was growing really quickly and there was a great opportunity and that I had some interest in the real estate world.
Excellent. Well, I don't know if anyone's journey to venture is straight at all. So long story short, you've been a great partner to us. So I'm glad we're all in the fold together. And maybe just to help set the discussion a little bit for our listeners, and I'm sure lots are already very familiar, but tell us more about Fifth Wall and its investment mandate, maybe including some high level data points about the focus areas and a little more context where you invest.
Yeah, absolutely. So Fifth Wall is a built world focused VC fund. We are the world's largest built world focused VC fund. We've got about $3 billion in total assets under management, and our investment mandate includes everything built world. So we're known for being kind of a real estate focused fund, but in reality, we're doing a lot of construction tech, as you know, and we also are looking at things in supply chain. We're looking at things in mobility. And of course, we have a whole climate tech strategy as well that really extends beyond just what's in the box. As far as just, you know, geography, stage, things like that, we're pretty broad at this point, just given how many different strategies we have. So I co-lead our early stage strategies, which is more seed, Series A, Series B, $5 to $15 million first checks. And I'm very much North America focused. But we do have a European prop tech fund. They're a little bit more early stage oriented as well. We've got a climate tech fund that does global climate tech at the early stage as well as the late stage. And then we also have a later stage prop tech fund that'll write larger checks all the way through pre-IPO. So quite a lot of different focus areas. And for us at this point, you know, we really cover the entire built world. And a big part of that has to do with, you know, our ever expanding LP base as well. So we have over 110 strategic corporate LPs, large owners, operators, developers, but also we have folks like a Lineage Logistics in Cold Chain, for example. And we also have folks who are GCs. So that just kind of really helps us expand our aperture and helps us expand our value creation ability as well.
Absolutely. We're going to go through and talk about that LP base pretty soon here and how you drive value. And incredible to say $3 billion AUM. I mean, Sarah, y'all started the firm in 2016. Is that right? When it got launched?
Yeah, that's right. I think late 2016.
Yeah. Well, great segue then. So incredible journey you guys have already had. So Fifth Wall kicking off in 2016 as a sector focused fund that was dedicated to real estate tech and innovation, and has now set the bar in many ways on how to grow, mature, and build an unfair advantage as a leader in a sector. Some may say niche. I think you and I know how big these niches are we focus on. with really this impetus, I think Brendan said this in the past, of using that compounding network to manufacture alpha versus wildcatting and venture, as maybe has been noted in the past. So since then, as the venture ecosystem has matured and we're all responding to changes in the world and the markets so that we can remain out front and seize opportunities, Fifth Wall has matured and expanded its product offerings into orthogonal themes such as retail, logistics delivery, sustainability, et cetera. So I thought it'd be fun. Let's go a little bit deeper to talk with our audience through that evolution of Fifth Wall and how it stayed true to its core while adapting to shifts in the macro micro landscape, which you're obviously finding new themes and places to invest. So we'd love to hear a little bit more about the story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so much of our expansion has really come very organically, I think, based off of just, you know, us extending our network of LPs and also us hearing kind of where our LPs' interest areas are, right? Climate is the best example of that. The main reason we launched the fund is certainly because, you know, the team had, and Brendan especially, had that thesis around climate being a major area of innovation in the next kind of multiple decades. But at the same time, we were also hearing that from the ground, from our LP base, and we saw the interest there. So that's really, you know, always been core to us, is kind of letting our LP base inform a lot of our thesis areas. And where I do want to clarify is, you know, even though we are really hearing a lot from our LPs and having, you know, their perspective helps us inform our thesis areas, that doesn't mean that we're only investing in things that our LPs can be customers of tomorrow,
sure,
right?
Mm-hmm.
For example, like I've spoken recently around SMB enablement. That's a big area of interest for me. And I actually have heard from a lot of our very large enterprise LPs that that's an area that folks need help in and where technology could be beneficial. So it doesn't always have to be, you know, super direct commercial relationship from day one, but our LP base just really helps us keep a very tight pulse on what's going on and what the priorities are in the industry.
Right on. And like you said, helps inform thesis development, as you guys are obviously doing your homework. Maybe just to tack on there from a diligence perspective, right? It's really powerful when you can deep dive into these operators and understand their pain points. And, you know, they probably have seen two, maybe tried, piloted two, or, and you've seen the other five or whatnot. So I'm just curious, how do you guys use this LP base when it comes to diligencing opportunities?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our LPs play a pretty meaningful role in our diligence process. Whenever we can, we're always going to reach out to them and hear who else they've spoken to, what their thoughts are as to whether or not this is even a real pain point that a certain company might be solving. And, you know, it's not the end all be all. Sometimes there's cases where, you know, a company might not be targeting our LPs as their initial go-to-market segment. Or in other cases, it's just our LPs all have a lot of different competing priorities. And this isn't number one, but that doesn't mean that it's not an interesting space. So for us, you know, we'll kind of take it with a grain of salt, but we very much, I think, value the LP's opinion. And, you know, there have been cases, frankly, where we've put companies in front of the LPs and, you know, the answer is this doesn't make any sense at all, or this is very much a nice to have. And that tells us a lot about, I think, the prospects of that business, especially in the current environment where, you know, as cost of capital is much higher, the bar is a lot higher for ROI and for implementing any new solutions.
Right. It's not just a voice of customer checkbox on a typical diligence process. It's just ingrained in your firm and what you do, which is a complete unfair advantage in a lot of ways. And earlier you mentioned, you know, Fifth Wall's maturity has grown into other asset classes specifically. Talk a little bit more about that and how that synergizes. You know, I know you're co-leading the early stage side, but would love to just tease out that last part about the firm.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the asset class expansion, again, has just kind of come organically, right? There's so much overlap across the different stakeholders in the built world. So, of course, you know, developers and GCs, for example, are working hand in hand in a lot on the construction side. And so as we've gotten kind of closer to kind of the developer side of the market and heard about some of their pain points, a lot of the tech that we started to look at ultimately started to skew towards construction. And we realized that there was a lot of opportunity there. There's also a lot of cross-pollination as well across asset classes. So we're always trying to take best practices that we see in one asset class and see if there might be ways to apply that to other asset classes as well, which also helps us kind of just extend the reach that we have across a much more diversified LP base. So good example of that is, you know, taking a look at how retail, for example, is a little bit more sophisticated with how they're using computer vision, and now trying to translate that into multifamily and into office and other types of asset classes.
Yeah, it seems all synergistic and just compounding again that network effect you guys have access to. So maybe moving us forward here, and we've already kind of talked on this a little bit, but let's go deeper on the LP base here. And you know, Fifth Wall clearly is differentiated. That has a diversity between, I think, Sarah, you mentioned over 110 owners and operators in the broader real estate industry and others from 15 countries, if I saw that stat right. So bringing deep sector expertise, and I think another term you guys have said, kingmaker networks, which is really powerful on one side of the equation. And then on the other side of the equation, premier financial LPs. So let's chat about two topics here. First, leveraging the network to add value. And then second, we'll come back to how do you balance LP incentives between strategic and financial LPs? So starting just with the first here, you guys are amazing at activating this powerful network of ecosystem players to add value and manufacture alpha again across the portfolio. We've been witness of it as we share our investments. So what does your team's playbook strategy look like for navigating these large and complex organizations to identify the right champions and then effectively foster those synergies with startups? And maybe to tag on to that, how does the firm maintain these LP corporate relationships closely given all the aspects pulling for your time as an investment professional?
Yeah, absolutely. So from a North Star perspective, we're ultimately an investment firm and a venture fund, right? So from my seat here, we're always going to orient ourselves around driving venture returns. And we would never invest in a company that, you know, LPs might like, but where we don't see there being a potential for a real venture return and being able to actually make money on the deal, essentially. So we do try to keep a pretty pure assessment on the companies themselves from a financial standpoint. That being said, to your point, like we have to balance our priorities and having kind of those large strategic LPs, we need to make sure that, you know, we're actually driving value not only from a financial return standpoint, but also from a strategic standpoint. And that's where having a dedicated partner coverage team really helps us ensure that we are balancing those priorities. Our partner coverage team regularly speaks to pretty much every single one of our LPs. They're hearing about what's important to them in that current month or quarter, and you know, sharing those insights with our investment team from a thesis generation standpoint, but also so that we can actually trade ideas. Because in a lot of situations, I might have spoken to a company that addresses a certain LP's need. It might not have made sense from a venture fund investment standpoint, but it did actually meet the LP's pain point, and we can still facilitate that introduction and try to help bolster the ecosystem as a whole.
Right. And is there, maybe I'm trying to think of any specific example that stands up of how in practice that has played out. And to your point, regardless of investment or not, you can still find these solutions that maybe directly answer their pain point. Any examples that come to mind, and then how that tactically happened between, you know, Sarah's out there scouting, finds a great innovator, and then now we're watching it get deployed at one of your investors' operations.
Yeah. I mean, we actually have quite a few examples of
sure.
this. You know, Document Crunch, our shared investment, is a good one where, you know, in a recent trip to the Middle East, we were able to get Josh connected to Fethi, who's our local partner on the ground. And he introduced Josh to two local GCs who are now both in contracting, right? And could be Document Crunch's first customers in the Middle East. And so just getting immediately to kind of the CEO level at those companies made sure that Josh was able to make the most of his time there. And we're looking at, you know, six figures in revenue from essentially just one or two meetings. So that's kind of, you know, the way that we like to do a lot of these more quick and dirty type introductions, so to speak. But we're also always thinking about more transformational type partnerships as well, right? Sometimes we'll actually even help a company launch a new line of business altogether. And so there's examples of that, you know, starting from day one at Fifth Wall with Open Door, where we were able to work with Open Door and Lennar to, of course, launch kind of their home buying, home buying initiative for new homes. And that's now, you know, a meaningful line item for them. And we're still looking at doing that for new companies that are coming into our portfolio as well, helping, you know, Neighbor, for example, in our fund two, really launch their owners program so that they're working now with more multifamily folks and other retail folks on the institutional level versus just kind of consumer owners of underutilized space to facilitate kind of localized self-storage solutions.
Yeah, too many examples, as you said earlier. And maybe just to ask, Sarah, so I would assume from an investment professional's standpoint, that really helps give you leverage to scale yourself. Did you say the team's name was the partnership coverage team? Excuse me, remind me.
Yeah, the partner coverage team.
The partner coverage team. So once you've identified like that partner in the Middle East, is it the partner coverage team that then helps kind of take the baton and really systemize how you engage, making sure things are tracking the right direction? And then as an investment professional, making sure you're kind of tracking at a higher level with the company?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So fortunately, with our partner coverage and value creation teams internally, they're the ones kind of helping with a lot of the more day-to-day ongoing brokering of commercial partnerships, making sure that, you know, follow-ups are happening, back channeling and getting good feedback. And that way, you know, from my end, I have a general pulse on what's going on and at a high level, you know, who a certain company might be talking to across their LP base. But it gives me the leverage to focus on investing, of course, and portfolio management kind of in the other functions such as hiring or board meetings and things like that.
Right. That's a fantastic model, and it definitely aligns with what it takes to manufacture alpha. So I use that word again. I really like it. Well, maybe let's take the second part of this LP question. And I think we could all agree strategic corporate LPs, et cetera, and pure play financial LPs have very different incentives driving their behaviors. And again, I think as Brendan has said before, with strategic LPs, quote, you have to know their why and be very clear-eyed why they are investing, which in my opinion, obviously is not to move the needle on their quarterly EPS performance. Not to say they don't care about financial returns, for sure, but that is definitely not the priority for the vast majority of corporates. And then on the flip side, financial LPs, they simply want top decile returns, right? Not too tricky. And they think a sector-specific strategy can produce those power law type returns that are really important to early stage venture. So all that said, how do you manage balancing those varying incentive alignments, both during a fundraise as well as call it more of that day-to-day operations, right? The annual general meeting, et cetera. How do you balance those two stakeholders?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, we're ultimately only underwriting, right, to a true venture return. We're not going to compromise kind of financial returns just because there is strategic value. In some cases, we are able to structure deals with favorable structure like warrants, for example, so that if we bring outsized value to the table, we can actually improve our returns profile by getting these warrants. So of course that could come into play and that does sometimes change the profile of a deal, but generally speaking, that's not the make or break and we're really underwriting deals on a true financial basis. However, you know, in terms of just deals that we really like and deals where we've seen a lot of success, a lot of those happen to overlap with our strategic LP's needs because we can really have that outsized alpha in terms of understanding that it's a critical need, that it drives your ROI, and then bring great value to the table that then helps that company continue to expand and scale. So I think that there's less of a misalignment than folks might think.
Sure.
Because, again, with the partner coverage team, we can also still show plenty of strategic value outside of the fund. Fistball is really a platform at this point. It goes much beyond just the fund itself. And so it's really kind of all of the teams coming together to deliver value in a much more meaningful way than, you know, just venture investing.
Right. And again, maybe just use one operating example for your AGM. I'm assuming everyone's in the same room mixing it up and the synergies between both the corporate and financials, just all one big network that's growing and synergizes off of each other, I would assume.
Yeah, exactly. No, we have one single AGM across all of our funds, and it's great. I think one of the things that we've had really positive feedback on from LPs is actually that opportunity to mingle, you know, again, across asset classes, but also across LP types even, and just trade notes and priorities.
Right on. Well, I wanted to spend some time as we've set up the episode so far. Just it is a great model. I'm obviously a biased audience to sector-focused funds, bringing differentiated networks. And you guys were clearly out in front, have made a great model behind you. So wanted to spend some time there. But maybe, you know, going beyond Fifth Wall, the model per se, let's dig in on what you specifically are seeing in the built world and tech trends that you're watching at the moment. And recently you posted on AI-enabled services plus the opportunity you see in serving SMBs in your focus areas. I'll make sure I link this in the show notes because it was great. And of course, lots of talk and attention on the topic of AI, you know, very ubiquitous term at this point, obviously. But take us a level deeper on how you are looking at AI and the power you see the tech being applied in the built world in particular as you focus on it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the built world is facing kind of a confluence of macro things that really make AI, you know, even more important, right? The labor shortage is kind of the biggest one. It's very true across skilled labor and construction, but also true kind of even for more service workers, right? Whether it's hospitality or property management on site or whatever else. So that's kind of a big macro headwind that the industry has had to face for several years now. And the other one is rising interest rates, which compress everybody's margins and makes it harder for deals to pencil out. So across both those things, there's a massive desire to find ways to cut costs and to run more efficiently. So AI is absolutely, you know, especially relevant. And it's not only relevant for the enterprise, which is very actively, I think, adopting AI across multiple fronts, whether it's, you know, some of the very basic chatbots in order to better manage tenant engagement and leasing and things like that, or kind of more complicated things. Like we have a company called TaylorBird that's helping, you know, visualize entire spaces with just publicly available images by leveraging generative AI on a visual scale. We have Document Crunch, which I mentioned already, doing, you know, fantastic things around just legal perspective and insights for contracts and risk management that's growing really quickly and that's, you know, helping folks save 80% of the time that they were otherwise spending. These are the types of solutions that we're really excited about, is, you know, the 5x, 10x improvements. And for me personally, like, AI is really just scaffolding, right? It's a way to build faster. It's a way to hopefully unlock solutions that weren't available previously. And it's, on the SMB side, a way to provide maybe full stack services and customer support and implementation support that you previously had to do with a human, which made, you know, serving those customers untenable. And now all of a sudden you can actually make the unit economics work, which is really exciting. So it's scaffolding and it's definitely exciting, but we're never going to invest in AI just for AI's sake, right? It has to be solving a real problem. And that ultimately is our focus, right? Is, are you helping solve the labor shortage? Are you helping, you know, speed up this specific workflow from 10 days to 2 days? That's the type of thing that we're really measuring, is that ROI more than anything else.
That's right. I mean, the tech can be a great enabler, but you mentioned two great examples, right? Tim and Ashish over at TaylorBird, former GE Ventures colleagues, but they know the domain. Tim came from a background, so using technology to solve an actual customer problem. And then, of course, Josh at Document Crunch, right? He was at RAGM on the stage talking about, I focus on customers, not just the AI, although it can be a powerful enabler. So I couldn't agree more. And, you know, maybe just to add on to that, just from a founder perspective, Sarah, do you have an archetype required from a built world investment perspective? Deep domain experience one side, maybe tech and product trying to figure out a market. Is there any, you know, I think we could say we're probably in the middle somewhere there, but any kind of archetype that you found from a founder deploying some of these advanced technologies that get you interested?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends a little bit on exactly where you're targeting. On the things that are a little bit more consumer facing, not as much. I think they're having kind of just, you know, standard best in class background experience scaling companies and building product is great. Where it starts to get, I think, more relevant to have industry specific backgrounds really comes down to when you're selling B2B, especially to the enterprise in the industry. We certainly see this in construction, and I think we see this across the rest of the built world as well, is if you don't actually understand and speak the language of construction or multifamily or whatever it is, it's very hard to sell.
It's really hard. Absolutely.
Yeah. So either you need to have that as a founder, or you need, you know, whether it's an advisor, you know, your first employee, someone on the team really needs to have that. And we've seen when you don't have that, that can be a real pitfall in terms of just the ability to scale a business.
Right on. Well, good segue there. Bringing it back to the founders out there building. I'd love to, at the end of the show, always come back to them and give them some words of wisdom if they're thinking about raising or maybe approaching Fifth Wall. So the question is usually maybe a key to success as they enter the discussion for you, and maybe a common challenge to help them avoid right out of the starting gate.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key to success is really staying very adaptable at the early stage, right? It's almost inevitable that what you started off with is going to change in some way, shape, or form. In some cases, people pivot entirely, and others, it's just adapting. But in those early days, you hear so much initial feedback. And I think the folks who we've seen be really successful are the ones who are able to actually, you know, intake that feedback and then build the thing that their customers are asking for, essentially, right? That I think is really important, and that kind of coachable mindset too, because especially for a first-time founder, there's just going to be so many things that you're doing for the first time. So, you know, leveraging your investors, your advisors, your friends even who've done this before, I think is going to be, you know, really, really time-saving.
Yeah, and I think I've only seen the Built World community investor founders. It's been a really collaborative community, because I think we all know it's all hands on deck to still scale. So a root for the home team here with the waving the flag to help recruit some more investors and folks to join us. So, well, finally here, Sarah, we always love to do a little quick hitter section, a little rapid fire Q&A. So if you're ready, we'll jump in.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. What, you can only get one, but what's the number one thing you look for when evaluating a founder building within this ecosystem?
Resilience. You're going to get told no a lot at the beginning.
It's a very fair comment. Great quality there. What's a resource? It could be a book, podcast, blog, whatever you recommend to our audience to follow in the ecosystem.
This might be a strange one, but I really recommend everyone reads Americana, A 400-Year History of American Capitalism.
All right. Tell more.
I just think understanding kind of historical cycles, historical waves of innovation, it actually really helps you put into perspective kind of what we're going through today and how that looks relative to the past. And it really shows you the importance of, you know, regulatory policy and everything else as a part of the grand scheme of things.
All right. We clearly have someone who studies their history here. I like it. One person who should be on the show and really help us keep promoting this ecosystem together.
I would definitely recommend Sarah Buckner from Trunk Tools. She is who I would think of when we say heavy hitter.
There you go. I like it. And finally, Sarah, best way for folks to reach out after the show.
Always happy to connect with folks who are spending time in the space on LinkedIn, and, you know, easy to reach over email too. Although, you know, as you can imagine, the inbox gets pretty crowded.
Yeah, well, someday we'll hit day zero inbox or zero, some magical dream like that. But jokes aside, Sarah, you guys have been great partners. You've been a great partner. And I think we both agree the power of sector focus and the networks that come with it really ultimately to help those founders out there building. So I think we got a lot of work ahead of us. The industries are changing fast, and I look forward to finding more stuff to work on together.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always great to work with both you and Adam on the Iron Spring team, and I really enjoy, you know, any investments that we get to work on together. So here's to many more.